He's been called a Rastafarian Stepan Fetchit, the most hated character in the Star Wars universe, perhaps the most reviled character in movie history. But he's also a light spot in a grim and humorless story, and he's a technological marvel, one of the first fully realized CG characters in cinema, paving the way for Andy Serkis to have a career. He's Jar Jar Binks, and the torrent of hatred from audiences when he debuted in 1999 almost killed the actor who played him. This week we want to have a frank discussion about Jar Jar. History has not been kind, but is it time we revisited him and re-evaluated him?
Miss you back!
You've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there, and welcome to Force Material. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And this is the show that's all about the secrets and the source material of Star Wars. This week, we're diving deep into the history of one of the more divisive characters, it's fair to say, Baz.
Yes, indeed.
In all of Star Wars canon, which is the one, the only, Jar Jar Binks.
Misa excited. We're drinking some very nice beer, actually. Star Wars themed.
Yeah, Baz has lined up some quite powerful. This is a Saber Staff. Actually, hit me, Baz. I'll get in on this.
Yeah, here we go. Get some of that down you. This is from Bacchus in Brisbane. And the guy who runs it is like a massive nerd and makes all kinds of Star Wars and Back to the Future and Ghostbusters themed beers.
It's pretty genius.
Yeah, this one is a double red IPA, Darth Maul themed. See what he's done there?
I do see what he's done there.
But it's an 11.
There's a little picture of Darth Maul in there in case he didn't see what he did there.
11%, uncompromising with assertive hop character. Anyway, and yeah, we're not sponsored by these guys.
No. no hashtag ad.
No money has changed.
It's just good beer. Yeah.
The other thing that we should be straight with you listeners, we're recording just before San Diego Comic-Con, and we're going to put this episode out just as that's coming kind of to a close.
Mm.
So we're not going to talk SDCC stuff this episode, but we'll probably do a catch-up episode later in the week.
Yeah.
Later in next week to just go through all the news that will come out of that. And we speculate there'll be quite a bit.
Yeah. There's probably not much point running through even what we speculate, because there will literally be, when this hits your podcatcher, there'll be another episode with us talking about what actually happened. So just listen to that one if you want to hear about our SDCC talk.
Yeah. And I guess the only other thing I should say this week is I fulfilled a long-held ambition of mine for my collection. I got my hands on a Legacy Millennium Falcon from 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sitting over there. How much of a beast is that thing?
It is an absolute beast. It is. I look at it, listeners, I don't get jealous of many things. I try not to, but this is amazing. This is quite a find Baz has come across here.
The lights, the sounds, it was incredible. There's a bit of a story behind how I got it. A friend of mine tagged me in a Facebook post from a friend of his who was found it in his garage, basically, and he was like, "This is just sitting around in my garage. I need to get rid of it. Does anyone know what it's worth?" Lots of people chimed in. I DM'd the guy and said, "I'll make you an offer for it. Send me a couple more pictures." So he did, and it's like there's bits missing and stuff, but nothing too serious. So I'm like, "Yeah, I can find those bits on eBay and put together a full one."
Yeah.
So yeah, I got it for $150 Australian off the guy, which is when you think about what these things go for on eBay now, incredible. Yeah. But I had to drive up to the Sunshine Coast to get it, which is like about an hour away from here in Brisbane. And the guy who was selling it is a local indie film director.
Yeah.
Chris Sun, who, I don't know if you're a genre film fan, you might know the horror films Charlie's Farm and Boar, which is just about to come out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boar is in B-O-A-R.
B-O-A-R, it's essentially, it sounds like a bit of a remake-ish thing.
Razorback.
Yeah. So he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
Really nice guy. It was nice to meet him.
Did you have to beat him in a game of Sabacc to take the Falcon, or he just gave it to you
for
money?
No, he just gave it to me for money. Yeah. It's fine. Nice.
No, it is. Yeah. It is a pretty incredible find.
I have no idea where I'm going to put it. I think it's potentially going to cramp our podcasting in this room. We may have to move to another room.
It's a look. It's worth it. It's a worthy sacrifice. Maybe that's not the only prominent Australian filmmaker Baz will be talking to this week, but we'll tell you more about that.
Yes,
next time
we will.
Mm. All right, Baz. Well, do you want to get into our the main event?
Yeah.
The story of the tragedy of Jar Jar Binks. It's not a story the Jedi would tell you, that's for sure. The
tragedy of Darth Jar Jar.
Exactly.
Yeah. So the idea for us doing this episode really stemmed from a tweet that Jar Jar Binks actor Ahmed Best put out about 3 weeks ago. So I'm sure most people have seen it because it kind of stirred up the Star Wars Twitter sphere.
Mm. To say the least.
Yeah. So it showed he put a picture of himself on top of the Brooklyn Bridge with his young son looking out towards the Statue of Liberty, and the caption read, 20 years next year, I faced a media backlash that still affects my career today. This was the place I almost ended my life. It's still hard to talk about. I survived, and now this little guy is my gift for survival. That's what Best wrote, and he asked his followers whether the tale of how that all happened would make for a good one-man show. And, you know, sold.
Yeah, 100%.
if he speaks about what happened to him, yeah, that would be incredible. So I've been doing a lot of thinking about that tweet. Like, it just keeps coming back to my mind a lot. I, like everybody else, pretty much hated Jar Jar Binks at the time. But I think I've warmed to him over the years. And I feel really sorry for Ahmed Best. And I know that in some small part, like, my hatred of Jar Jar Binks and my trashing him did contribute to that misery that he went through. And I feel terrible about that.
Just in the sense that, you know, the collective
hatred,
you know, of Jar Jar.
Bandwagon jumping hatred of Jar Jar. And, you know, I know that nothing I specifically said ever reached his ears, probably, or wrote ever passed his eyes. But, you know, it was still out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about you?
I mean, I'm sure I've done my fair share of Jar Jar bashing over the years.
Yeah.
100%. I didn't... I don't have strong memories of hating Jar Jar like a lot of people did when The Phantom Menace came out. I remember actually really enjoying the movie. See, I was 12.
Yeah.
So I was the perfect age. So I was a little old for Jar Jar. Like, so a lot of those jokes I was like, "Oh, come on, guys. Yeah. Like, this is serious business here. This is Star Wars." But I didn't like hate him.
Yeah.
And I still really enjoyed the movie. And I remember, I was telling Baz this off air the other day, I remember having arguments with people at the time because The Matrix had come out just beforehand. And I was already such a Star Wars lifer that I was arguing with people at school that The Phantom Menace was better than The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else was like, "You're clearly on some sort of drug." Which in retrospect, yeah, okay, The Matrix is a better movie than The Phantom Menace, obviously. But, you know, I still have really fond memories of that movie.
I would argue that point.
Oh, really?
I've done the flip the other way, I think. I was 25, 26 when Phantom Menace came out. And I watched it with the jaded and cynical viewpoint of someone in his mid-20s who felt that Star Wars owed him something after all these years.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were bits of Phantom Menace I loved at the time, but the overarching memory I had of it was of Jar Jar and Anakin kind of carrying on like silly cartoon characters.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of diminished it for me. But and the rest of it was so turgid and serious that there wasn't just any relatable levity like there was in the original trilogy.
So now, I want to talk about this for a sec. So you mentioned in the opening, I was going to say the opening crawl, but that's not, doesn't really apply. But anyway, you mentioned in the opening that it's a very grim and humorless movie.
Mm.
I don't know if I agree with that necessarily. I think Phantom Menace is pretty fun. I think you could definitely make the case that maybe Attack of the Clones or Revenge of the Sith is pretty grim, but I think Phantom Menace is it's basically a boy's adventure tale. The pod race is a lot of fun. The pod race announcers, there's a lot of jokes during the pod race.
I'll give you
and
the
they're
pod
not
race.
All Jar Jar based. Like,
I think the pod race is the only bit that doesn't deal with trade disputes and government maneuverings.
It's funny. It's hard too, because when you rewatch it, it's a funny movie. But sometimes it's not intended to be funny. It's just there's so many memes that it's you just laugh upon that's the line from the meme or whatever, you know. Yeah. So it's hard to say. But I remember at the time thinking it was actually a really fun movie. I don't know if history agrees with me on that. But
well, I remember thinking it wasn't, but 2 weeks ago, I sat down to watch it again and with fresh eyes, clear mind, open heart, all that kind of whatever that phrase is.
Yeah.
And I guess three things perhaps now inform the way I watched it that wouldn't have informed the way I watched it at the age of 26.
Yeah.
And that's, well, first of all, Ahmed's tweet.
Yeah.
That just makes you look at it in a whole different way.
Mm.
I mean, this is a guy who's just given a performance. You know, it's not, he didn't write it.
Mm. Yeah. Know?
Yeah. Secondly, I guess I recently became a dad, as some of you might know. That affects me. That makes me think of this film as, yeah, this maybe is for younger kids. This maybe, you know, there's a young kid in the lead.
Mm.
Maybe this film is going to be more for the younger Star Wars fan and more identifiable for them.
It is interesting. I mean, we're kind of seeing now almost like vindication for George 20 years after the fact, because his big thing at the time when fans sort of expressed their displeasure with the prequels was like, yeah, that's great. This isn't for you.
Yeah.
Like, this is for the people who were your age when the original movies came out. And I think those people have like...
Does he say he's going to make it for his kids?
I think he probably did. Oh, that's a drink.
Yeah, we'll drink.
That's a drink. Mm. but yeah, so he, you know, he always said that this was for the kids.
Yes.
You know, that Wu-Tang is for the children, and so are the so is the Star Wars prequels. And now I think we're kind of seeing those kids have all sort of come of age. I mean, hey, you know, raise his hand.
Yeah.
And they love the prequels. Not all of them, obviously. Yeah. And I'm probably skew closer to the older fan view on them, but they do have a lot of, you know, they do have a lot of supporters now. And there's a lot of people who really love the prequels because they grew up with them. And they're the movies that they have this nostalgic attachment to and that they happily overlook all the flaws in, the same way that, you know, that we do for the original trilogy.
Yeah, that's right. And there are a few.
Yeah.
I guess the third thing that really got me thinking about Phantom Menace is the toxicity a certain corner of this fandom has been putting out in recent weeks and months. We don't talk about that on this podcast a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something we're consciously avoiding. It just doesn't come up a lot in the course of us delving into, yes, but what was George Lucas doing in 1986 or whatever? You know what I mean? Like, that which just tends to be our focus. But yeah.
I don't particularly want to get enmeshed in the podcast wars.
No, but it's not like, I mean, you know, there is a right and a wrong in the universe, and it's not hard to tell which side is which.
I fought in the podcast wars. I was once a social justice warrior like your father.
Yeah, so you know, obviously that the Ahmed Best thing does sort of bring up a lot of those spectres of.
Yeah,
you know, it resonates with the. It's like poetry; it rhymes with the toxicity we're seeing in the fan base today.
Yeah, so I mean, most of that was centered around The Last Jedi and about how divisive that movie in theory was. I didn't find it divisive.
No,
I loved it. But you know, people are saying, well, that's the reason Kelly Marie Tran was bullied online to the point where she gave up her accounts. You know, we don't have proof for that, but she's given up her accounts.
Mm.
But can we trace the big problems in Star Wars fandom as far back as The Phantom Menace?
I think you can. I mean, I think you can, honestly, like, I think you can trace it back even further if you want.
Quite possibly,
there was a thing somebody shared recently on social media, so I can't remember who it was off the top of my head, but it was a letter somebody sent to, you know, Star Wars Insider or Star Wars Galaxies or one of those sort of publications in the 90s. It was, I think it was pre-special edition, and it was just this vitriolic letter, like, oh, you know, hasn't George Lucas had enough time to go off and make the other films he wanted to make?
Yeah.
Where, you know, I've been waiting for 10 years. Where's my Star Wars prequels? He promised me. And, like, real angry sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But kind of the way now, I guess, people sort of talk about George R.R. Martin.
I was just thinking
about
that.
But, you know, like, it was very, like, oh, wow. Like, I think overall, this guy's done much more good for you and your life than bad. Why do you have this attitude towards him?
Yeah.
And so it goes back away. I mean, Pablo Hidalgo shared something on Twitter this week that I thought was really interesting, which was and we might even dig into in more detail in a future episode, but it was a link to some info about this sort of battle that was being waged in the fandom in the 80s and is now only really documented via, you know, surviving zines or whatever, between Han Solo fans and Luke Skywalker fans. Wow. And there was this article that ran in like a fan publication back in the 80s, and it was talking about something to do with that whole battle, but it was talking about how a lot of fans were disappointed with Return of the Jedi, and it had sparked a lot of debate in the fandom. And I thought the way they, again, you know, this is an article from the 80s, but I thought it was really interesting because they talked about it in terms of like, you know, a lot of people are really disappointed with it because in the time between Empire and Return, so many fans had come up with their own theories about what they thought was going to happen in Return of the Jedi. And then when that didn't happen in the film, people were really disappointed because they'd built this thing up in their head that didn't happen. And it's like, yeah, wow, where have we seen that before? So, yeah, I mean, I think it goes further back, but probably in terms of like, just that's kind of fringe. We're talking about fringe dwellers of fandom there.
Yeah.
But in terms of like, just
major mainstreamy backlash.
Backlash almost becoming like the norm as opposed to the outsider kind of opinion. Yeah.
So when George Lucas finished the prequels and sold the company, he said to the New York Times in 2012, "Why would I make any more when everybody yells at you all the time and says what a terrible person you are?"
Yeah.
And that's one sentence, but it sums up a lot of the stuff that we know about how George feels about making Star Wars films so many years on.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, he then immediately started writing new ones and sold the ideas to Disney. But it was a very sad quote to read at the time. Yeah.
There's the case of Jake Lloyd, famously. He was bullied both online in 1999 and beyond and in real life. I mean, he was theoretically bullied on MySpace then.
Yeah.
Which is even sadder. But
MSN Messenger.
Yeah.
ICQ.
ICQ. So he Jake retired from acting after The Phantom Menace came out. And just a couple of years ago, you know, he got into a high-speed police chase. He spent 10 months in jail, ended up in a mental health facility being treated for schizophrenia. So it's not gone well for Jake.
Yeah. And you know, obviously, like we've talked before about, you know, people have their demons and you never know. That stuff might have all happened if he'd just been Joe Schmo, who wasn't Anakin Skywalker, or if the peak of his cinematic career had been Jingle All the Way, all that stuff might still have happened.
Yeah,
but it probably didn't help all the vitriol he faced since he was a child for just playing a role the way that George Lucas asked him to play it.
Yeah, and then there's the case of Ahmed Best himself. So as we know now, he was driven almost to suicide, turned on by fans and the industry, and his career never recovered from playing Jar Jar Binks. So let's talk about Jar Jar. I'm not talking about revisionist history, just talking about revisiting the character. We should have a chat and see if he's redeemed himself any in the you know, if we've got a bit of distance and we can think about him in a different way. He's always been a problematic character. He probably always will be to some extent.
Yeah.
And you know, the P. Yusa kind of fart joke is the worst moment in all of Star Wars.
It's a low point. Yeah. It's a low point. You'd have to dig into like the Ewok films or whatever to find a lower point, and I don't think they count for the purposes of, you know, for me, that is the worst moment in any Star Wars movie.
But Ahmed Best didn't write that moment.
Exactly.
So, you know.
He was just following orders.
Yeah.
So not to imply that Ahmed Best is a Nazi.
So let's get into this. Let's do a forensic examination of the intent behind Jar Jar, where he came from. Let's try and look on him with an open mind and a bit of, you know, compassion, understanding what the actors and filmmakers we're trying to do, so you might want to buckle up, baby. Here's a retrospective of Jar Jar Binks.
Excuse me.
So there's a great quote from George Lucas in the making of Phantom Menace documentary, The Beginning, I think it's called.
Yeah.
He says,
the best Star Wars documentary of all time.
Yeah, it's great. He says, Jar Jar is the key to all this. If we get Jar Jar working, because he's a funnier character than we've ever had in any of the movies before. So George clearly thought he'd struck gold here with this idea of having a character called Jar Jar Binks. So first of all, what do we think he meant by the key to all this? He's the key to the plot. He's the key character that people will respond to. Is he the key to merchandising the whole thing? Or technically, is he the key to getting all the visuals to work? Or is it all of the above?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's probably a little bit of, all of the above. But I think the main thing there that he's talking about when he says, you know, it's quite an infamous quote at this point that Jar Jar is the key to all this quote. I think he's just talking about in terms of the visuals.
Yeah.
I think he's talking about like if the audience doesn't believe that Jar Jar is real.
Yeah.
So not just the visuals, but you know, it's the performance, it's the way everybody else responds to him. But he's the most outlandish thing in the movie. And he says in that quote like that he's, you know, the most like
the funniest
character that they've had. So if the audience doesn't feel like he's real and he's part of that world that we're seeing on screen, then the whole movie falls apart because you've suddenly got this giant, you know, like this
cartoon
huge, yeah this yeah. cartoon in the middle of your movie. And you know, for a lot of people that is that is how they felt about him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think he looked pretty realistic for what he was.
It's funny, I think, you know, he might look realistic, but I think George probably thought of him as a cartoon. In 2015, speaking at Disney's D23 convention in Anaheim, and therefore after the sale, George said to a crowd, "I can't even begin to tell you how much of an influence Disney has had on me. I will say one secret that nobody knows. Not many people realize that Goofy was the inspiration for Jar Jar Binks. I know that you'll look at him differently now. It's pretty obvious, actually, but I love Goofy and I love Jar Jar. I just try to remember back to what it was like when I was young and what I got from Disney." So, yeah, Goofy was the inspiration for Jar Jar Binks. And when you think about that, it kind of makes sense.
You know? It does. I mean, if you watch the footage, I think he was maybe a little bit tongue-in-cheek about it. It was probably one of those things. There's definitely some truth in there, though.
Yeah, definitely.
He definitely is a very goofy type of character.
Mm. And he went through a few changes from his early design stages. Jar Jar was at one point meant to have a sidekick, a dog-like creature called a Blarth.
Oh, God.
Which, yeah, it survives in only some, you know, dusty concept drawings by an artist called Terrell Whitlatch in The Wildlife of Star Wars, A Field Guide, which cites it as being laid-back, good-natured, and has a constant desire for attention, oftentimes leading to innocent disaster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thing looks a bit like a miniature Jabba the Hutt. It's very fat.
Right.
It's got a big, long tail, you know, looks a bit like a slug with tiny legs.
So he would have had, it sounds like, like some of the more comical characteristics that we ended up sort of attributing to Jar Jar.
I think so, yeah. It might have been good. You know, it might have softened Jar Jar's like ridiculous level of clumsiness if he'd had this thing that was there to do all the sort of visual gags and the fart jokes and the falling down kind of humor.
Yeah.
It might have made Jar Jar a little bit more relatable if this dog thing was just a foil for him.
And then they could have just sent Blarth back to his home planet after episode one and then Jar Jar could have carried the rest of the way through the trilogy.
Yeah, but you know, on the flip side, it could have been as bad as the dog thing from John Carter.
Woola.
The Woola. It absolutely
could have been.
that would have been terrible.
That's the, yeah, when you were talking about a little alien, that's why I was like, oh God, because that's what sprung to mind.
Yeah. But, you know, it would have been weird too, because it would have been like a Goofy Pluto situation where, you know, you've got these two kind of idiotic, animalistic kind of creatures, but one of them's the master, one of them's the kind of pet.
It's just the arbitrary nature.
They're both dogs, people.
Yeah, it could have raised a lot of ethical questions, I guess.
Yeah. And also, the artist Ian McCaig had come up with the idea that Jar Jar's bones were made of elastic, which would alter his body shape in different levels of gravity and under different levels of pressure. So, you know, I guess on certain planets he'd be more of a boss and ass style, kind of fat, blobby physique because the gravity's pushing him down. And I guess if he's underwater, he might lengthen out, like, because he's weightless and, you know.
Yeah.
Or the pressure might squeeze him. I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked, because we don't really deal with gravity in Star Wars, do we?
No. And if you do, it's one of those things you don't think about, because there's no way Luke and Leia are still the same age if they've been on circling different suns. And yeah, no, it's best not to think about it.
No. No Nolan-directed Star Wars films.
Yeah, exactly. The rubber bones thing is definitely interesting.
Mm, yeah.
It's just got me thinking, like, you know, this is, what, 99, this is Space Jam era. Jar Jar Binks could save the day by just sort of stretching out and dunking on the droids, Michael Jordan style. That would have been amazing.
He's like the Reed Richards of
the Star Wars universe. Yeah, yeah.
Except maybe not quite as intelligent. Yeah, that one really doesn't work.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. We've talked about this on a previous podcast, but the origin of the names Jar Jar and Gungan deserves a little bit of examination too. Mm. So, George Lucas says they came from nonsense words that his son Jet made up.
Would you say that he said he was doing it for his kids?
Yeah.
Drink.
Oh, drink. Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers.
So yeah, Lucas told Rolling Stone, "I just like the sound of it. I'm always on the lookout for interesting sounding words. I have to come up with hundreds of them, and I don't like names with X's and Z's in them that people use in space films."
Yeah.
Like
Shizor.
Shizor. Elan Sleaze Bagano. Yeah. I always come back to him.
It's a great one.
But look, in an earlier podcast on, of all things, the classic film Gunga Din, we mentioned that we came across another couple of possible origins for the name Gungan.
Mm.
To save you the bother of going back and looking up this podcast, although do, because Gunga Din's great.
It's a great app.
Well, George is a print the legend kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
So who knows which one of these is the real way it worked. But
Could have been a little bit of both. Like maybe Jet came up with Jar Jar and, you know, Jar Jar Binks, but then Gungan was a result of Lucas's research into this other stuff.
He said his name, he made up the words because he described tractors and trucks or something like Jar Jar, tractor, Jar Jar. I don't know. He said that's what he said. It was Jet's words for tractors and trucks.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, the mind of a child. Wonderful. Yeah.
But we know that George has a fondness for global mythology, and Gungan has the same root as Ganges, the holy river in India, which only became Ganges when the Brits started calling it that, in a very colonial way. But there's another more crazily coincidental connection. Right here in the wetlands of Brisbane, Australia, is one of the few places in the world where you can find several small species of frog called, now I'm going to get this wrong, but Uperolea rugosa, also known as the sandy, eastern, or chubby Gungan.
Ah, moi moi.
So we've got the name, we've got the look of this character basically down. Now we need to look for a person who can play the guy. So enter Ahmed Best at this point. He's in his early 20s. He's a singer, a dancer, a drummer. He's been raised in the Bronx, educated in New Jersey, where one of his schoolmates was Lauryn Hill of the Fugees.
Amazing.
Yeah. Fun fact, Best was a Fugee for 2 days.
What?
He told Rolling Stone this back in, I think, 99. He said, Lauryn Hill's my homegirl. We went to school together. I was a Fugee for 2 days. Didn't elaborate on it. Journalists didn't press him.
What?
But there you go.
That's the single greatest fact that's been unearthed in our little...
I would love to ask him about
pop culture archaeological expedition here on the Force Material podcast.
Wouldn't you love to ask him about that?
100%.
Let's see if we can get him on
Twitter. Were there no follow-up questions to that from
Rolling Stone?
Yeah.
No, this is solely about Star Wars and Music Magazine. We don't want to talk
about don't want to talk about the Fugees. Fuji jar.
But so he was focused on more of a musical kind of bent. His only film experience was as a kid extra in Lean On Me, that 1989 film with Morgan Freeman.
Can't say I'm familiar with it.
Yeah, it didn't make a big splash. But Ahmed Best spoke to Vice in a wide-ranging interview in 2015, which is a really good resource for this podcast, and we'll come back to it throughout. He recounted how he was spotted on stage initially and recruited to get Jar Jar's movement right. He said, Robin Gerland, who cast Star Wars, pulled me from the San Francisco run of Broadway musical Stomp because they were originally looking for movement for the character. I just embraced it so strongly and I embodied that show so much that when Robin saw me, she immediately wanted an audition. So Robin Gerland had come along to Stomp in San Francisco on one of her off nights and gone, that's the guy we need for Jar Jar.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Stomp?
I have actually, yeah. It's quite a good show.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Stomp.
Yeah. It's a good show.
I think I saw it in Glasgow.
I think I saw it over here.
Mm.
It's entirely possible I'm confusing it with like Tap Dogs or something because I was very young. But I'm pretty sure it was Stomp. Pretty sure it was Stomp.
So making this even more sort of crazy story, the night that Robin Gerland had come to see the production, Best had been relegated from lead role to supporting role to make room for an out-of-town Stomp cast member who was visiting the city. So, you know, they kind of put them in the lead role as a guest for the night.
Oh, no.
Bess was absolutely fuming. He said, I turned into an a-hole that night. I thought, if you can out anything on me on stage, you've got another effing thing coming, and I'm going to prove it. And I did. Had I been a little bit older, I would have handled it a little bit more gracefully.
He seems like such a nice guy in every single interview I've ever seen with him. It's hard to imagine him being, like, angry.
Yeah, I know. But that was an interview with Wired that he did in, I think, 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the rest is history. He got callbacks for that role, and on his final callback, which was a motion capture test, he met George Lucas. And he felt that he was something of a guinea pig for the motion capture stuff. ILM had a team still writing the software at that point. So,
wow.
You know, they were basically, he was in the funny suit with the baubles on it, and they're still tapping away on keyboards. It's crazy. When he met Lucas, Best thought he had screwed up the audition completely due to George's customary tight-lipped manner. He said to Vice, I was doing all these moves and George had a very specific idea in mind of how the character was supposed to go. He very much wanted him to be more of a Buster Keaton than anything else. I was really, still am, into martial arts and acrobatics, so in my mocap audition I was doing backflips and high kicks. It was more like athletics and he kept trying to pull me back from being so athletic and a bit more lanky and long and silly. There's that great moment in the beginning documentary where Lucas is acting out
what he wants best to do.
Yeah.
Swinging his arms and got the shoulders up. It's very funny.
So it's kind of like that moment Ron Howard was talking about recently when Lucas visited the set of Solo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that moment where Kira takes off like a jacket or something.
Yeah.
And in the script and the way they blocked it out, Han put the jacket or whatever it was. He put it up on the it was a cape. It was one of those capes, obviously. And he put it up on the cape rack. And George happened to be there that day, and he was like, Han wouldn't put that back on the rack. And Ron Howard says that George Lucas just kind of like became Han for a second to show him what Han would do. He'd just like throw it over his shoulder onto the ground. Just like that super, just that Solo swagger just possessed Lucas for a second. And it's the same thing in the beginning with the spirit of Jar Jar inhabiting Lucas's body.
Yeah. But, this is a weird thing. It nearly wasn't to be, because Ahmed Best wasn't top of mind for George Lucas when he initially sort of was thinking about who could play the character. Best only found out about this after he was cast, when he was with George and Natalie Portman and George's kids at Wembley, seeing Michael Jackson in concert during the Phantom Menace filming, or just afterwards. So he recalls being taken backstage to meet Michael and Lisa Marie Presley. And he says, George introduced me as Jar Jar. And I was like, that's kind of weird. Michael was like, oh, okay. And I thought, what's going on? So after Michael had driven off, we all go back up to a big after party. I'm having a drink with George. And I said, why did you introduce me as Jar Jar? And George said, well, Michael wanted to do the part, but he wanted to do it in prosthetics and makeup like Thriller. George wanted to do it in CGI. My guess, says Best, is ultimately Michael Jackson would have been bigger than the movie. And I don't think George wanted that.
It's fair.
Yeah.
It's fair.
Can you imagine that if Michael Jackson in prosthetics had played Jar Jar Binks?
Is it possible for Jar Jar to be more hated than he already is? Because that's how that would have ended up.
Yeah. Retrospectively, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, even at the time, I think people would have been like, wow, that is a huge distraction from the story.
Somewhere had gone to see Captain EO a few too many times. Yeah. So look, we've got this guy who's a consummate performer, a really good master of movement. We've got this character who's been cooked up to be like the comic relief and have these certain characteristics. What went wrong? What was everyone's problem?
This is very, very bad.
With this character. So when one of the most damning indictments, I think, was Time Magazine's assessment of Jar Jar, who called him a vexing, endearing mix of Kipling's Gunga Din and Tolkien's Gollum. That's just a strange way to sum him up, but I guess it's sort of accurate.
I mean, the Gollum reference is quite prophetic, really, when you consider that he ended up sort of paving the way for Andy Serkis to perform as Gollum in the Lord of the Rings movies.
Absolutely. So among the other things that people seem to specifically dislike about Jar Jar were, first of all, the cartoonishness of the character. Secondly, there were accusations of him being a bit racist with his kind of Jamaican-y dialect. Thirdly, there was the out-and-out slapstick vaudeville school of humour, which, wasn't really that well-known in Star Wars at the time, apart from a couple of C-3PO, pratfalls, etc. Didn't really fit in with much of the tone of the rest of the film, which is, as we've mentioned before, about political manoeuvrings and Jedi Knights looking all po-faced and stabbing people with their laser swords. And I guess a certain element must have been the merch oversaturation, because I remember when Episode 1 came out, I got really back into Star Wars collecting in a big way during, the whole Power of the Force revival. Phantom Menace comes out, suddenly Jar Jar's on everything. And there are 50 different Jar Jar figures that all do different things. Like, well, this one's got a tongue that comes out, and this one, and there's the tie-in stuff with the infamous lollipop, where you open his head and you have to lollipop out where his tongue is, and there's just everything. Jar Jar bath bombs and all kinds of things. So what do you think? I mean, did you think he was just too much everywhere?
I think if he'd been good in the film, that wouldn't really have mattered. Because, if you look at BB-8, BB-8 was ubiquitous before the release of The Force Awakens. And it's hard to get sort of more, a more analogous situation than that. And everybody loved BB-8. When the movie came out, people loved BB-8 because BB-8 was awesome in the movie. I mean, I'm sure there are, you know, some people who didn't like him and thought he was overexposed and all that sort of stuff. But the general consensus was that people really loved BB-8 and were, like, jazzed to see more BB-8 in future movies as opposed to, like, you know, relegating him off to little minor cameos in future movies.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think all that Jar Jar stuff is definitely, like, the oversaturation is definitely part of it.
Mm.
But yeah, I think if he'd been like a beloved character, it wouldn't really have mattered that he'd been oversaturated.
Is the moment where BB-8 shoots casino tokens like the closest we've got to Jar Jar
in the sequel trilogy? Yeah, and it's one of those things like I laugh, it's funny, but it is a little, very prequel-y.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. So, so Lucas knew there were issues with people understanding Jar Jar's weird speech patterns, but he seemed very cavalier about it in that Rolling Stone interview. In 1999, he said, "When we first saw it, some people that had never seen him before didn't know what was going on. They had a hard time following it. So we redid it, but I still kept that kind of dialogue." Lucas pointed out that no one understood Yoda at first either. "Now everybody can," he says. "The first time you hear Jar Jar, it takes about halfway through the movie to figure out what he's saying. Once you figure it out, it's easy. If you go back and see it a second time, you can understand him all the way through."
Yeah.
Now, is that the height of arrogance?
Like, I mean...
I don't care if you can't understand a major character for the first half of the movie. Just go see it again.
I mean, it's definitely the Christopher Nolan approach to dialogue, but I mean, is it arrogant in 1999 to assume that people would see The Phantom Menace more than once? Well, I don't know if it is.
It's not,
I don't know if it is. I think that's just pragmatic. I think it's realistic that fans were going to see it more than once.
But is it like, well, he clearly knows there are problems. He's redone the dialogue once.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows that people still can't understand it.
Yeah.
So that's just all pig-headed. You know, Lucas kind of not wanting to bow down to the fan pressure. And he's going, "Well, I don't care if you can't understand it. We're going to do it my way, and that's fine."
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the character may have been a bit more successful if that stuff had been toned down a little to the point where, you know, you could get on board with him the whole way through.
I don't find him that difficult to understand.
I don't either, but I can't remember the first time I saw the film.
Mm.
So I may have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Possibly.
I mean, I know everything he says now. There's still some of the stuff that I don't understand, like what a hay blibber is.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, a lot of it makes sense. Like, there's context cues for everything, though. You know? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I see what you mean. It is, there is definitely an element of arrogance there for sure.
Yeah, and look, we should talk about the large racist elephant in the room as well. we probably, you know, as two sort of middle-aged white guys, we probably have to be a bit cautious.
Hang on. I was going to object, but if the shoe fits.
We probably don't have any right to talk about anything touching SW Rep Matters.
Oh, but, no, 100% no.
But, you know, but we should talk about, like, what effect that had on how Jar Jar was perceived. So, I mean, there's some aspects of Jar Jar that might make you a little bit uncomfortable and put you in mind of a kind of racist caricature, mostly due to the way he speaks, really. So, yeah, I grew up in the UK and there was a comedian on TV back in the 80s called Jim Davidson.
Mm-hmm.
White as the driven snow. I think he was from he's from the north of England somewhere. He used to do routines with this ridiculous, exaggerated West Indies accent as a character called Chalky White.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I'm damned if Jar Jar doesn't remind me a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know. But yeah, when The Phantom Menace came out, Joe Morgenstern of the Wall Street Journal called Jar Jar Binks a Rastafarian step and fetch it, as we said in the opening crawl, on platform hoofs crossed annoyingly with Butterfly McQueen. So a bit of context there. He was referring to a guy called Lincoln Theodore Monroe Andrew Perry, born in 1902, who found fame in the 30s as an American vaudevillian comedian and actor. He was of Jamaican descent and considered to be the first black actor to have a successful film career. His comic persona was Steppin' Fetchit, a kind of a lazy, somewhat dopey comic relief character who frequently just doesn't get it, not unlike Jar Jar. Perry himself couldn't have been more different. He was a highly intelligent guy, a singer, dancer, writer, very far from what this character was. But as the civil rights movement in the US grew, Steppin' Fetchit came to be seen as kind of an embarrassing anachronism who just perpetuated this negative stereotype of black people. Butterfly McQueen, who was also mentioned, played Scarlet O'Hara's maid in Gone with the Wind in 39, and she was typecast as other kind of similar characters to that, like subservient black characters. Mm-hmm. So you know, obviously Morgenstern's review was kind of damning in his eyes, but Best has a rather firm view on his name being associated with Fetchit, which he shared with Vice. He said that it just further underscores the ignorance and the blind unrealness of dealing with racism in this country. The lack of education, the lack of exposure to what is actually racist to non-black folks is abysmal. For anyone to say that is offensive because it shows the ignorance of not knowing what Rastafarian is and not having proper education and knowledge of what minstrelsy was in the time of vaudeville, Butterfly McQueen and Stephen Fetchit, they really don't know what those roles were and why those roles were. I think that ignorance and lack of education that's pervasive in this country not only allows criticism like that to be actually voiced without any type of proof, it also allows what goes on in modern filmmaking as far as limited roles for black people. Black people have experiences other than the jail and gang-related stories being shown in movies today. There's nothing wrong with playing a brother in jail, as long as there's a lot more to the character than I kill people and I'm black. So Morgenstern's criticism underscores that lack of intelligence and original ideas in folks who try to understand the black experience in entertainment.
Boom!
What do you make of all that?
I mean, it's definitely... It's interesting. I'm inclined to agree with Ahmed on this. I mean, I feel like he has, you know, he's got a better idea of what's,
for sure, yeah,
you know, offensive to him as a black man than, you know, than someone who is not a person of color.
Yeah, it sounds like Morgenstern was offended on his behalf without realizing that it wasn't offensive when you realize and understand where it all comes from.
Yeah, and that's a whole, you know, whether it is offensive or not. I mean, if people do take offense to it, like, I think there's certainly, you know, it's a very justifiable position.
Yeah,
but it's definitely interesting. You know, I don't think it's something that either of us really.
It's a world away from our experience.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's interesting to hear Best's perspective on it, for sure.
And there's a guy who has a perspective on it that you will not want to argue with. Mm. Mr. Samuel L. Mace Windu Jackson.
Well, I don't want to argue with him about anything.
No. He stepped in to defend Ahmed on that count as well. He said to the Associated Press in a 2002 interview that critics inferred a racial stereotype only because a black actor did the voice. I thought it was pretty stupid, he said. The fact that Ahmed was doing that character may have sent people to that place, but people want to find things, or they want to assign things to everything, and that's not always necessary.
Mm.
So, yeah, good point. Best poured a bit of water on the Jar Jar's Jamaican controversy in 1999 in that Rolling Stone piece. He said, "That's a really big insult to Jamaican people. Just because the language is a bit different, they stick an accent on it. Jar Jar has nothing to do with the Caribbean. He's an amphibian from the planet Naboo." One reporter at the Phantom Menace press junket was concerned that Jar Jar, being of Caribbean of descent, was perpetuating the slave mentality by being in a life debt to Qui-Gon Jinn. And Best said, when that was thrown up at the junket, "You know what? You got to check your head and examine your own beliefs. Jar Jar is an orange frog. Heads need to relax. That's just crazy. I just thought I was doing a funny role. I didn't know the Jedi were a metaphor for the man."
Yeah, I mean, that's another interesting one because, I mean, obviously, yeah, on one level, yes, he is an amphibious frogman. It's hard to, you know, read too much real life, you know, racism into that. On the other hand, that's kind of like, I mean, that's like saying the Ewoks don't have anything to do with the Vietnamese Viet Cong people, but, you know, they do. So there are obviously, you know, real life parallels for a lot of these. A lot of these characters. So, I mean, yeah. I can go either way on that, to be honest.
But that press junket was the same press junket where reporters were desperately trying to get Best to say that Jar Jar was gay.
Oh, God.
So, you know, Best said they wanted a scoop. I guess they wanted to get the gay amphibian community in the movie.
I mean, Jonathan Kasdan would have just said, yeah, he is.
Yeah. He's pansexual.
He's pansexual, yeah.
He's, So it was actually at junkets like that that almost immediately the hate for Jar Jar started rolling in. Because his face wasn't seen on screen, Best told Wired in 2017, he was stuck in a cruel limbo that few actors experience, a state of being infamous and anonymous all at once. He said, "It's really difficult to articulate the feeling. You feel like a success and a failure at the exact same time. I was staring at the end of my career before it started." George said, "This happened with the Ewoks, it happened with Chewbacca, it happened with Lando Calrissian." He was used to this. He knew it was going to happen. He didn't.
Yeah, I mean, the strength of the backlash must have surprised him to some degree.
I reckon, yeah. I think it took everybody unawares.
Yeah.
Yeah. Best said in a YouTube interview with Jamie Stangroom for These Are the Actors You're Looking For. That was 2 years ago he did this. He said he took it hard because he put a lot of his own personality into the role and was emotionally invested in it. He said it was really painful. He took on the role partly as a challenge. He wouldn't know this at the time, but it would be the forerunner for Andy Serkis's Gollum, the Na'vi from Avatar, and lots more. I was to be the template for this, so I was kind of working with George to pioneer this new character form of acting and storytelling, he said. He said he understood why people hated Binks, though. When they see a character that's purely comical and purely for the children, they felt probably a bit condescended to. But he said it didn't make the backlash hurt any less. Ahmed told Vice in 2015 about how when he first got an inkling of the backlash at those press junkets in New York City, he was specifically talking to a New York Post journal, which he characterized as a paper that feeds on gossip and negativity. He said it's a very American thing to take somebody down when they're at the top. People really wanted to see George crash and burn.
Just on that, it's interesting that an American would say it's a very American thing to take somebody down when they're at the top, because that's all in Australia.
That's Australian.
We see that as a very Australian thing. We call it tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah.
I wonder if maybe it's a thing that is actually just a very human thing, and everybody in every country thinks that it's like unique to their country.
So unfortunately, this character was so new and so experimental, Best said. He became a lightning rod for all that, wanting to take George Lucas down. It was me and it was Jake Lloyd who took a lot of the heat for the movie. Fortunately, I was in my 20s. I wasn't 8 years old like Jake, who I think took it worse. Jake had it far worse than me. I'm a 20-year-old from the Bronx. I've seen and I've done things that were a lot harder than that criticism in the newspaper. Although it hurt me emotionally and it was hard to take at the time, it wasn't debilitating for me. I just put my shoes on and went back to work. But Jake had a difficult time. The amount of vitriol he took as an 8-year-old was just wrong, and it affected him. There's always going to be somebody who tries to poke holes in what this thing is, but what hurts is when people try to attack the actors personally. At the end of the day, we have very little to do with what the movie looks like, feels like, sounds like. We're trying to get the director's vision on the screen so the director is happy, and we can move on and do another project. So when folks were holding Jake accountable for final decisions that George made, it was completely unfair.
Yeah. That's fair. I mean, this actually, this kind of brings back the, you know, you mentioned the Kelly Marie Tran situation earlier. It's interesting because when that was all, you know, really raging a few weeks or a few months back, there was a sentiment I saw a few times expressed by people that I thought was a bit strange, where people would say things to the effect of like, and I saw people say this like unironically, as far as I could tell. Like it wasn't Kelly Marie Tran's choice to write Rose that way. Like let's harass Rian Johnson instead. And it's like, hey, why don't you just not harass anybody?
that's a
wild, you know, it's like, yeah, okay. They made a movie you didn't like.
Yeah.
Cool. Like there's, you know, hundreds of them come out every year.
Yeah.
Watch one of them. It's fine. Like, make that the thing you obsess over instead. That's like, obviously, you know, we're two guys who sit here every fortnight and talk about Star Wars. So, you know, obviously we can't criticize anyone for obsessing over Star Wars. But, like, we get, you know, enjoyment out of it. Like, it's like a positive thing in our lives. We like talking about it. Like, there are some people who just seem to, like...
to like talking about it negatively.
Yeah, and it's like it's just like they just use the internet as like their argument machine. Like it's just their way of like they've got all this, you know, all this sort of hatred bottled up, and it's like, oh, I'll take it out on George Lucas, or I'll take it out on Rian Johnson, or I'll take it out on Jake Lloyd, or, you know, Ahmed Best, or whoever the case may be. And it's like, it doesn't actually matter if you liked the movie or not, you know, just don't do that. Like just don't. Why are you like that? What are you doing?
You've gone wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Best was asked if anyone ever took the anti-Jar Jar criticism too far, by which I infer physically far. And he said most people were smart enough to at least not say anything to his face.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, he said, acting is fun, but I will knock you the F out if you step out of line. That's just where I come from. Respect's a big deal. I wasn't always a happy-go-lucky filmmaker. I was the kid on the streets for a minute. I know what the streets look like, and that's still in there a little bit. I think people are smart enough to know not to go there with me.
Okay, so two things there. First off, you can't not hear that in your head in Jar Jar's voice, yeah, which is hilarious. But second, I believe him.
Yeah.
I mean, like he's got those, you know, he's got the range. He's got those range, long arms.
He's got the martial arts experience.
Exactly.
His dad was a martial arts instructor.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's, you know, yeah, don't mess with Ahmed
Best.
Yeah. He's hugely physically fit. He wore that stupid costume, the $100,000 one in the Tunisian
desert, yeah.
Man, he's, yeah, don't mess with him.
Yeah.
He will knock you the F out. but, you know, people did take it too far. Maybe not to his face, but he had death threats on the internet many years before proper social media was even a thing, as we've said. Someone set up a JarJarMustDie.com site before the film was even out.
God.
Hundreds of people actually went on there and paid $5 each to join the International Society for the Extermination of Jar Jar Binks, paying to get JarJarMustDie.com email addresses.
See, now,
before the film was even out.
I must say, though, as sad as that is, that's how you do it, remake TheLastJedi.com.
Yeah.
Take people's actual money, not just their vague promises. Have you seen how that website works?
Yeah.
You just have to, like, put in your name and a dollar amount that you're willing to donate, but yeah, you don't actually donate anything. And so they're like, oh, we've raised like $20 million. It's like, no, you haven't. Like, people have randomly said that they might donate, but like, nobody's made any commitments to anything. At least these entirely reasonable JarJarMustDie.com people were bilking real money out,
yeah,
of people.
That's right. Like the remake Last Jedi, guys, that's the Star Wars equivalent of sitting in a park next to Wall Street doing a drum circle.
Yeah.
It just doesn't do anything.
No.
But and then there was the film editor from Santa Clarita called Mike J. Nichols, who put together the Phantom Edit, which I don't know if you've seen a copy of that, but it basically kind of removes most of Jar Jar from the film. I think it has him talking in an alien language and subtitles him.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So basically, you know, you can give him more intelligent dialogue for the, yeah, few scenes that he's left in.
And yeah, also I think it's just, you know, for people who didn't like the voice or whatever, that's wandering, yeah, around it, to just lean harder into the alien,
that's right,
nature of the character. And, you know, like,
yeah, nice calling card for Mike J. Nichols.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Yeah. Like, I've had brief interactions with him, yeah, on social, yeah, media. He seems like a good guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, that's... It's, yeah, like we talked about previously, there's a difference between like a fun fan project, you know, editing, re-editing the movie in your spare time as a calling card for your editing abilities, as opposed to trying to raise $200 million, yeah, to actually remake the movie.
So I don't know what Ahmed's contract looked like when he signed up to do Phantom Menace. I assume it was a three-picture deal. Most of these things are. But
you don't think he was on that Marvel nine-picture deal?
He may have been.
Jar Jar spin-offs. Yeah,
he may well have been. But in much the same way as Harrison Ford, Best ended up pleading for his character to get a big death. He'd just come off this. He'd been ripped for Phantom Menace. Didn't want anything more to do with it, so he just wanted to get killed.
That's probably the first time anyone's said that Jar Jar was much like Harrison Ford, by the way.
Okay. Well, have we seen the paternity test for Kylo Ren?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he told Jamie Stangroom in that YouTube interview, I always complained to George when I realized that Revenge of the Sith was pretty much not going to have Jar Jar in it, and they were moving very far away from me. I always complained to George that I didn't get a good death. I wanted to really just be hacked to pieces in some kind of way, and George wouldn't do it.
That's very Star Wars. Yeah. That's very... There's a lot of scenes in the films where people just get hacked to death, yeah, on screen.
Yeah. Mostly in... Well, there's an arm off.
What am I talking about? It actually is one of the signature traits of the films. I'll shut up.
Two arms and a leg.
Yeah.
Cut in half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, fair enough. Fair enough.
Hands everywhere. So many, yeah, hands, you're just tripping over hands. But he did kind of come back to Star Wars after doing the films. He did a few episodes of Clone Wars.
Which were great.
He actually hit his stride as the character in Clone Wars. I mean, that's one of the few episodes of Clone Wars I've actually seen.
Yeah.
A couple of the Jar Jar ones, and they were good. And he deliciously voiced his character in those Mickey taking robot chicken specials, which were great.
Yeah.
Remember that one where... Darth Vader, he comes back to Darth Vader.
Yes.
Darth kicks him out of the airlock.
Yes.
Then he becomes a Force ghost and hangs out with Darth Vader forever.
Amazing.
And that's probably why Darth Vader is so evil.
Yeah, no, they were great. And he's great in those specials.
And he popped up with his own face on screen briefly in Attack of the Clones, in the Coruscant nightclub scene, playing an officer called Ahmed Beck.
I'm looking at at an Ahmed Beck action figure.
They made a figure of him. It's great, so we know exactly what Ahmed looks like.
Yeah,
it's great. But you know, he's done with Star Wars now. He told Vice, "I'm good. I had my experience. I did my thing. Now it's for a brand new generation. It's for John Boyega. I'm done with it. I'm really resolved to being done, and I'm okay with that." So, speaking before the movie came out, and before the backlash, obviously, to Rolling Stone, he said he hoped Jar Jar was in the next movie, so he hoped Jar Jar was in Attack of the Clones. George hasn't said that, but he keeps alluding to the fact that Jar Jar will be back. "I hope so, because they're going to shoot the next movie in Australia. I love Australia, and being part of the Star Wars universe is nice. You get to get up every day and play Star Wars and get paid for it." He loves Australia. How good is that?
It's the oldest trick in the Win Australians Over in Interviews book. Just say you love Australia. We all fall for it every time.
Yeah.
He could have met those Gungan frogs you were talking about in Queensland. He could have come up and found some.
Ahmed, if you're listening, come down. We'll go out to Boondall Wetlands. We'll find the Gungan
Absolutely.
Frog.
Absolutely.
That'd be such fun. You get to come to Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good time.
And find something that reminds you of probably the worst time in your life. No, that's not a great idea. No. We'll do something else. We'll just have a pint. He did have one big champion on set. His co-star Liam Neeson absolutely loved working with Ahmed. And Liam Neeson's from my home country.
Well, there you go. And he love it, though? Because we know Ahmed loves Australia.
Does he love my home country? Does Liam Neeson love Northern Ireland?
Does he?
He sent back the keys to the city of Ballymena because he said he had a horrible childhood there. So,
well, I was not expecting any other answer other than an ambiguous, unambiguous yes. So that's interesting.
He probably doesn't love it that much. I think, I can't remember who it was that said this, but was it Oscar Wilde? "I showed my affection for my native land in the greatest possible way by getting out of it as soon as I possibly could." I don't know if that was wild, but certainly someone prominent in Irish said that.
Well, that's a very Luke Skywalker way to approach life.
Yeah.
Does Ahmed Best love Northern Ireland, though?
I'd say he probably does, if he likes Liam Neeson, and who doesn't? So Liam Neeson told Rolling Stone in 1999, "I really do think Ahmed is a young Eddie Murphy. I was just aware of his discipline and the hard work he had to do, but he always did it with this incredible joy and spontaneity. I thought, this guy's something. When the film ended, I told everybody, my agents, everyone, you've got to get this guy."
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's a glowing endorsement from the guy from Taken.
Absolutely. He should have shown up in one of the Taken movies. It was getting, it was getting a bit ridiculous by the end that they kept taking his family members. But what if they'd just taken Ahmed Best?
Yeah.
And then he had to go rescue him. That would have been amazing.
Mm. But you know what, though? It wasn't just the fans that disliked Jar Jar. The industry kind of turned on a little bit too. I think the industry...
Wasn't just the fans, wasn't just the critics.
No.
It was also the industry.
I mean, it was kind of friendly fire in some ways. And I want to talk about a couple of these things that went on, because they just seem like... They may have been done in fun, but maybe they contributed to the pain that Ahmed felt about how his character was received. And it can't be easy when, the people you were working for who made you do this and you're copping all the blame for it, turn around and kind of throw your character to the wolves.
Mm.
So I'm talking specifically about... it's funny that it's almost on San Diego Comic-Con when we're going to talk about this, because this thing happened around San Diego Comic-Con in 2012. The big figure that everybody was chasing was Jar Jar Binks in Carbonite, the San Diego Comic-Con exclusive figure. Jar Jar Binks in Carbonite on a vintage collection card. And that was based on an idea that fans had come up with for Celebration 3, but they decided, Hasbro decided to put it out. So it was like an official limited release, and it seemed really cruel to me. I just, I've seen it and I don't like it.
It's funny because on the one hand, like, you say that and I'm like, that was funny when they did that. And like, I kind of still want one. On the other hand, I think that's only funny in an environment where people can have a friendly joke with each other.
Yeah.
It's probably, if you did it now, like if they released a Rose in Carbonite figure.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
Oh my God, that would be...
Heads would roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess when you look at it from that perspective, it's unbelievable they did that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, yeah, like, you should be able to, like, have a laugh and make fun of things that you don't like with other people who are also not terrible garbage people, but have opinions about things they don't like. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's just fun. But I can see looking at it from today's perspective, maybe not a great idea.
Maybe 2-3 years ago, I would have thought it was great fun too. Maybe I would have gone for one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a big collector of that scale, and I don't know if I ever really want that in my collection.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just a bit of a weird one.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm hitting up eBay looking for Jar Jar and Carbonite right now.
Well, the video game community got in on that as well. I think the Jar Jar and Carbonite thing appeared in The Force Unleashed as well, just on a wall somewhere in a trophy room. And rumor has it that a life-size statue of Jar Jar and Carbonite once hung on the walls of Lucasfilm. And look, there's a recent example, and this is kind of bittersweet because I think it was handled quite well, but it's still quite sad.
Mm.
So I'm talking, of course, about the Chuck Wendig novel, Star Wars Aftermath: Empire's End, which you haven't read.
Haven't read. Nothing like, you know, against the books or whatever, I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah, so very minor spoilers here, I guess, if you haven't read it, but it's been out for like, what, a couple of years now. So
Spoil away. I know what happens.
Yeah. So it's a set post Return of the Jedi, and Jar Jar pops up again as an old Gungan in Theed City, Naboo. He's just hanging out by the fountain. He's a street performer, and he gets to know a young refugee boy in just this one little one-shot chapter, which is only 3-4 pages long. Here's an extract. It's really sad. Since children started coming in by the shipload as refugees, the Gungan has served them, performing for the kids once or twice a day. He does tricks, he juggles, he falls over and shakes his head as his eyes roll inside their fleshy stalks. He makes goofy sounds and does strange little dances. Sometimes it's the same performance repeated. Sometimes the Gungan does different things, things you've never seen, things you'll never see again. Just a few days ago, he splashed into the fountain's centre, then pretended to have the streams shoot him way up in the air. He leapt straight up, then back down with a splash. And he leapt from compass point to compass point, back and forth, before finally conking his head on the edge and plopping down on his butt. Shaking his head, tongue wagging. All the kids laughed. Then the Gungan laughed too. The clown, they called him. Bring the clown, we want to see the clown. We like it how he juggles glombo shells or spits fish up in the air and catches them, or how he dances around and falls on his butt. The little boy at one point asks Jar Jar why no one talks to him. My no sure, the Gungan makes a hmm sound. Misa thinks it caused Jar Jar making some uh-oh mistakens. Big mistakens. Der Gunga bosses banished me long out ago. Misa no been to home in for ebbers. And Disa Hiss and Naboo think I helped the uh-oh empire. There's a glimmer of hope at the end as the boy seems to express some interest in becoming a clown, but it turns out that Best kind of approves of this fate.
Really?
You know, as sad as it may be for Jar Jar just to be this nobody kind of hanging around juggling for kids. He was asked about it in that Jamie Stangram interview, and he said, it's a very somber, very dark eventuality for Jar Jar. I quite liked it, actually. It was a really dramatic, and I think a good idea to kind of sum up. So there you go.
Yeah.
Jar Jar approved. And then this is a bit of a stab in the back, in my opinion. There's an extract from a Vanity Fair interview with a journalist called Bruce Handy in June 2015. And it makes me think a little bit less of The Force Awakens director and franchise kickstarter J.J. Abrams. At one point during the effects review, while watching a sequence with spaceships flying low over Jakku, Abrams asked to pause the scene. With a light pen, he drew a little squiggle on the sand dune. I have thought about putting Jar Jar Binks' bones in the desert there, he said. Everyone laughed. Abrams laughed too, but insisted, I'm serious. He pointed out that the shot zips by in a second. If that. Only 3 people will notice, he said, but they'll love it.
Does that really make you think less of J.J. Abrams, though?
It does a little bit. Like the idea that people would take pleasure in the demise of a character that was designed for little kiddies, and I think it's just also cruel. This is what drove Ahmed Best to suicide.
First off, he did
suicidal thoughts. Yes,
but it's just like, I think when people who are actually involved in the franchise make little, like, that's just some like good natured ribbing,
is it?
That's how I see it. I'm okay with that, but I can see how it doesn't come off great.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you know, when you think of this as being a character that, like, George really loved and that George, you know, intended for the kids and...
For the kids.
Cheers. But yeah, I mean, I can see in that sense, it's a bit cruel. But, I mean, it's like a half a second visual slide gag. I kind of wish he'd done it. No, that's that's not true. I'm glad he didn't do it. It would have.
Would you rather he put him in carbonite?
See, and the better thing,
or have him as a homeless beggar.
In this era, that would have been 6 months of articles about, like, JJ is trashing the prequels or whatever. If he'd put that shot in there, so it's good that he didn't. But it wouldn't have been the end of the world if he did. And I think Ahmed Best probably would have seen the funny side of that.
He probably would now.
Yeah.
Do we know for sure what JJ stands for? I mean, maybe he has a personal vendetta because his parents cruelly named him.
That's why he just has to go by JJ now. Yeah. He's like, I can't go by my real name anymore because of this guy.
Yeah. So all that stuff kind of combined to make Ahmed Best feel that he'd been abandoned by everyone in the entire entertainment industry. And it wasn't just that stuff. It wasn't just the stuff that there were snide little digs against Jar Jar. It was the fact that, you know, the phone didn't ring after Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
He told Wired, "To be honest, failing and being black is very scary because we don't get a lot of chances, you know. I didn't get another chance after Jar Jar. No one said, you know, that didn't work, but I believe in you and you're a good actor," with the exception of Liam Neeson, who did. "I just struck out," Best said, "but as soon as I started doing my own thing, that's when things took off." He continues today to work on his own projects, including working on a web series, going to film school, getting really into martial arts. He's a jiu-jitsu black belt. And last I heard, he was developing a comedy series with Jay Lee called Two Black Dudes. Like, I think it was a web series as well. So, you know, he's doing his own creative stuff. He's in a decent place. He's got some stuff going on. But it's all self-driven. Like, Hollywood didn't come knocking after The Phantom Menace. And I find that really sad because he's a talented guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't even go back to Stomp, which he was clearly very good at.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it makes sense people wouldn't be like, knocking down his door after The Phantom Menace based on The Phantom Menace. You know what I mean? Like, but at the same time, like, he's obviously a talented guy, and it's a shame that maybe being in The Phantom Menace cost him opportunities he would have had otherwise.
Mm. But let's look at the good stuff about Jar Jar, because, you know, everyone talks about the ridiculous antics and the silly dialect and blah, 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 but there were some really great things that came out of that character. I guess one that's become more clear as time's gone on is that Jar Jar is sort of an omen for our times in a way. He's this goofy, well-meaning, slightly dim character who's been used as a political tool to give birth to the Empire. And that just seems more poignant week by week to me. I mean, the new canon, I guess, is that Jar Jar ended up splashing around a fountain as a clown, but what George had planned for him in the end was much more subtle. There's no question Jar Jar played a much smaller role in Attack of the Clones or Revenge of the Sith. What's always been unclear, however, is whether that was because the character just didn't serve the needs of the story or because George was just so shell-shocked after the brutal criticism he received that he just didn't want to put him in any movies. He hasn't talked about it that much, but Best has his suspicions. "I think George wanted to give the fans what they wanted," he said in a 2014 Reddit AMA. "That meant more lightsabers and less Gungans." And he added that while his character's personality was largely unchanged in episodes 2 and 3, there were huge changes to his story arc. Talking to Entertainment Weekly in 2012, he described a deleted scene that was filmed for Revenge of the Sith. He said, "In Revenge of the Sith, there was a scene where I'm walking down a long pathway with Ian McDiarmid, the Emperor, before he's turned into the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And Palpatine kind of thanks Jar Jar for putting him in power. It's a really interesting scene, and it shows the evolution of Jar Jar from this fun-loving kids character into this manipulated politician. And there was an interesting arc for the character that I thought could have been explored, because the scene is really dark. But it just didn't fit in the movie, which I understand. But yeah, George's take on it is that Jar Jar is now just a politician. I guess it's not quite as obvious as a scene literally depicting Jar Jar clowning around in a fountain for spare change and being reviled by his peers, but still a tragic end to Jar Jar Binks, a once noble creature with the innocence of a child subsumed and corrupted by the dreary, treacherous and sinister world of grown-up politics.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's still in the films to a degree.
To a degree, yeah.
But yeah, it's very much like blinking, you miss it sort of appearances in episodes 2 and 3, really.
And you kind of, you know, cartoon characters are running the world now.
Yeah.
You know, that's where we are.
Yeah.
So Jar Jar Binks as a politician may have seemed ridiculous in 2003.
Yeah.
But, I mean, every day now we see someone say something stupider than anything Jar Jar Binks would have said.
100%.
You know, and I'm not talking just about one guy. Like, we're talking the whole Brexit thing
that's
coming apart at the minute. Like, everybody in the UK is just, yeah.
That's it. It's not just Trump. It's like, there's this whole spectrum of
and just
clowns.
Yeah.
If anything, the most unrealistic thing about Revenge of the Sith in retrospect is like, is that this genius level manipulator would be the Emperor rather than Jar Jar.
Yes.
You know, but everything else is pretty spot on.
That's right. Well, we'll get into that in a minute because I've got some thoughts on that. But one of the other great things about Jar Jar, and you cannot deny this, is that he was a motion capture pioneer. Last October, Best tweeted out, "I don't know how to retweet this and not sound bitter, but I feel I've been forgotten, no disrespect to the great Andy Serkis." And he retweeted a tweet from a media professor at Washington, D.C.'s American University, which links to a Wired story. And that professor said, "The erasure of Ahmed Best's pioneering work as Jar Jar Binks from this history of motion capture is at best revisionist, possibly racist." And in that piece, Andy Serkis is talking about the history of motion capture, especially as it relates to himself and Weta. He's, of course, played Gollum. He played Caesar in the New Apes movies, which is great.
Yeah.
Just a brilliant performance, and many, many more. But the video just flat leaves out Best and Lucas and ILM and Jar Jar, who together successfully did a proof of concept for using a fully computer-generated supporting character in any feature film. And it's the first time it had been done.
I mean, he, 100% should be recognised for that. I don't know if it's racism, per se.
That's maybe a bit of a long bow.
I wonder if it's more just a case of, you know, history is written by the victors, and people really liked Andy Serkis, so we tend to think of him as this breakthrough character, and you don't really want to attribute these breakthroughs to a character that, like, nobody liked, and that's why he tends to get written out of those histories. But, I mean, yeah, he absolutely shouldn't be.
Yeah. But Serkis is standing on the shoulders of giants, isn't
yeah.
he? But, you know, and Best has a point. His character's contribution to cinema history is often disregarded. Despite any problems you may have with Jar Jar the character, he's still a technological trailblazer in the grand Lucas and ILM tradition of technology trailblazing everything since 1976. Of the 45 animators that worked on Phantom Menace, 15 were assigned solely to Jar Jar. Think on that.
That's insane.
Like two-thirds, or one-third of the resources completely assigned to just one character.
Well, he was the key to all this.
He's the key to all this. So Lucas sank a lot of money and time into making sure that this would work. He saw him as like Yoda kind of on steroids, you know. Lucas said to Rolling Stone, "It was the first time I could get an alien to turn in a really great performance. When we did the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, that was when I realized that we'd finally developed the ability to do a photorealistic animated character that's believable. I was able to do it with Yoda, but Jar Jar could actually move around and walk with the character and do physical humor." Ahmed Best told Vice that he agreed maybe the timing of the technology was slightly to blame for some of the Jar Jar backlash. The filmmakers, as we've said, were experimenting with the new software on the spot as they worked. "The first one out of the gate is always the bloodiest," he said. "I know I'd probably have more of a career if Jar Jar came out now. It was very difficult at the beginning for me to explain exactly what I do. No one really believed that I, as an actor, could bring this thing to life. They thought it was more the power of industrial light and magic animators. So I was on the other side of the Andy Serkis argument. Everybody thinks Andy brings the character to life and then the animators just come along. When I was in it, everybody thought the animators brought the character to life and I was just a model. Now you can be a motion capture actor and have a career. Peter Jackson and Andy Serkis together really pioneered that thing. Peter Jackson made sure that everybody knew there was an actor behind Gollum. I don't think that Lucasfilm understood at the time because everything was just so new."
Yeah. And there, that you 100% see that in the you know, the way that people talk about Andy Serkis. So he's absolutely right. It has completely flipped the other way, where now the animators don't really get any credit for the work that they do. They're seen, it's just treated as like digital makeup rather than like, you know, them playing their part and bringing this character to life.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, with Jar Jar, I don't remember anyone in 1999 really talking about Ahmed Best. It was all, it was all about the, you know, the technological breakthrough when people talked about him. So yeah, it's interesting how that kind of, how that reversed over the years. And again, I think that has something to do with the fact that like people liked Gollum and people like Caesar. And so you want to talk about this actor. it's like when a movie fails, like, and everybody blames like the screenwriters, but when a movie does well, nobody talks about the screenwriters. Everybody talks about what a genius the director is. Like you kind of just want to like, you know, lay blame somewhere.
Yeah. The other great thing about Jar Jar was that Star Wars has always been about comedy. Discuss.
Yeah, I think I've said on this podcast before, or definitely on the blog somewhere before.
Yeah,
I think comedy is like the sort of secret, underrated X factor of Star Wars. Yeah. I think the ones that work are funny, and the ones that don't work aren't funny. And you know, I mean, A New Hope, we saw it a couple weeks ago, as you said, saw it with a crowd. It's still funny. Yeah. It still works. People still laugh at, you know, like, we're fine here. How are you? And all those. I mean, that's my favorite Star Wars moment. Yeah. And like, it's still funny. Like, it's full of like fun little, you know, one-liners or little moments like that. And, you know, Empire is funny.
Yeah.
Return of the Jedi has its moments. Force Awakens. I mean, the thing when I knew we were in safe hands with The Force Awakens, like, I mean, you know, real sets, practical effects, all of that, that's fantastic. But when I knew that this was going to be, you know, that Star Wars was back, was, who talks first? Do I talk first? Do you talk first? Like, Star Wars is funny again. Like, you know, people who, like, have a really good, and it's not that George, obviously, like I'm saying the original trilogy was quite funny. So obviously, George had a decent, you know, he doesn't really get credit for it, but he obviously had a decent feel for the humor in those original films.
Yeah.
Something went away in the intervening years to where, like, I mean, there's funny, as I said before, there's funny moments in the prequels. I think there's definitely moments that are, like, intended to be funny.
Yeah.
I just don't know how many of them really land.
Yeah.
I mean, Obi-Wan, Attack of the Clones, like, you know, we've come to rescue you. Good job. Like, that's funny. Like, but generally, like, there's not a lot of, like, really real laugh lines that work
in
the prequels.
That's true. I read a great piece by a guy called Ed Cumming. He wrote in The Guardian 2015, which is all about the humor in Star Wars. And he said Star Wars' secret weapon was always humor.
Yeah,
the films were never afraid of a C-3PO, Chewbacca, or Ewok to serve as a foil for all the Jedi portentousness, a quip or a bit of slapstick to lighten the mood. This was the series' real force. The invisible field that led the story about a farmhand's quest to murder his genocidal father be classed as family entertainment. And he's right. I mean, Jar Jar may not have always hit the mark with his kind of vaudeville slapstick routines, but he's at least funny in an old school kind of way. Ahmed Best knew a lot about film because his father was a photographer and a cameraman on Good Morning America for like 2 decades.
Yeah. Right.
And also, as I said, a martial arts teacher,
yeah,
which is pretty cool. So Ahmed grew up around film, and he told Vice, "I'd seen a lot of Buster Keaton movies growing up, and I was a huge fan." That's the second time we've mentioned Buster in this podcast, so clearly a touchstone. I was also a fan of Charlie Chaplin. Anybody who can communicate a message without speaking is incredible to me, and that influenced me. Stomp as well. When I was sitting down with George watching movies and coming up with moves and motivation for the scenes, it felt like something I'd been doing my whole life. George and I watched Buster Keaton movies together and talked about him. Some of the Jar Jar scenes are direct Buster Keaton scenes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you got to think about that. I mean, George, clearly his film education goes back a long, long way. And he's thinking about, you know, Buster Keaton's the same era as Buck Rogers, which he lifted a lot of stuff from.
Yeah. You know, Lucas has always been sort of a cultural magpie. Like, he sort of takes these you know, things that work from all sorts of different genres and then kind of mashes them all up in Star Wars. I mean, we've talked ad nauseum about how he does that. And, you know, obviously, yeah, Phantom Menace is where he, you know, you mentioned before there's little moments of sort of slapstick with C-3PO, particularly in the original trilogy.
They just lie entangled in a bunch of wires going, I'm sure this is all your fault.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
That's very Jar Jar kind of moment.
Yeah, but Phantom Menace is definitely like where he just... you know, leaned fully into that's silent, you know, silent film comedy kind of influences.
That's right. Lucas told Rolling Stone, I think the comic relief character is an important dramatic device. Some of the fans that want the Phantom Menace to be the Terminator don't like the idea that there are comic characters in it. I certainly am not going to make a grim blood fest out of Star Wars.
Yeah.
Quite rightly so, until he started murdering younglings.
Yeah. But I mean, that's kind of what I was talking about at the top of the pod with, like, when I saw this and I was 12, like, I guess, as I said, I still loved the movie, but I do remember kind of thinking, like, Jar Jar's pretty goofy. Like, I thought Star Wars was, like, serious. This is serious stuff, man. Yeah. This is the fate of the galaxy, whatever. But yeah, like, it has always been funny.
I mean, Ewoks cop a lot of... They probably did at the time cop more flack than even Jar Jar did.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? But that's not one single person, is it?
No.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's... George has never taken Star Wars as seriously as, you know, a large section of the fan base takes Star Wars.
Yes.
So, like, I think for the most part, you know, he's always been aware of the importance of comedy. You know, whether or not it works in all of the films is up for debate, but he's always known you need that secret sauce.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe he took it a little far with Jar Jar, but, you know, it's not completely out of place.
Yeah. And, you know, Best knew that by the time Revenge of the Sith rolled around, as we've said before, there's no room for Jar Jar. He's a purely comic character. That's a really dark story. He told Vice there was nothing about that film that needed to be comedic, which was Jar Jar's whole purpose, to bring light and levity. By that time, there was none. Yeah. And, yeah, bang on. So why would there be a role for someone, you know, hooning around talking about hay blibbers?
Yeah. there's still a couple little laughs in Revenge of the Sith. But yeah, I
unintentional ones. Oh, there I go being cruel again. I shouldn't be cruel. We mentioned briefly before about the Darth Jar Jar theory. We should talk about it. This would be incomplete without
if we must.
So I think it was around 2015 that this, you know, intriguing theory started doing the rounds on Reddit. Yes, Jar Jar gave Palpatine his emergency powers, allowing him to take over, but is Palpatine an unwitting pawn in Jar Jar's big game? Is that why, as George Lucas said, Jar Jar is the key to all of this?
No.
Look, we won't go into all the evidence that people have put together here for Jar Jar being this massive manipulating Sith Lord that's a rung above Palpatine.
It's on YouTube if you want to look it up.
There. A lot of it. Some of it's more compelling than others. But what it did do, I guess, is like bring Jar Jar back into the conversation in a way that wasn't negative. You know, if people are trying to make Jar Jar a Sith Lord, doesn't that kind of make him a little bit cool for a second?
I think that's what it is. It's like an attempt to like almost retroactively... yeah. You know, like, oh, these movies are, like, are silly, and I want Star Wars to be very serious, so I'll retroactively make Jar Jar into a very serious character. And obviously, I think whoever came up with the theory originally was just having a joke, and they were very tongue-in-cheek about it. But then there were people who sort of almost seemed to be taking it seriously, because they wanted Jar Jar to be building up to this darker thing. So... I don't know. I mean, the Darth Jar Jar theory was very funny when it was first posted.
Yeah.
I laughed. We all laughed.
But you know who did buy into it? Ahmed Best bought into it, right?
Yes.
So in late 2015, when this Darth Jar Jar theory was lighting the internet on fire, Best put up this tweet. I will say this. It feels really good when the hidden meaning behind the work is seen, no matter how long it takes. #TPM.
You don't think maybe that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek?
Look, well, you know that video interview he did with Jamie Stangroom? He said in 2016, what I can say about it is, and I kind of said this on Twitter, there's a lot about it that's true. There are some things that are not true. Could Jar Jar have evolved into that? I think the answer is yes, because of the backlash, and rightfully so, Lucasfilm backed off from Jar Jar a lot. but a lot of the influence I put into the character mirrored a lot of what was already in the Star Wars universe. So was there an official Darth Jar Jar in the works? That's really a George Lucas question. I cannot answer that question.
I think what he's probably talking about there is this idea that, you know, you mentioned earlier that Jar Jar was originally going to be seen to have a larger role in Palpatine's rise to the top as an unwitting simpleton being played by Palpatine, which is still in the films, but just not given, but just not given the screen time that it maybe was originally going to have. But I can't imagine there's any reality in which George actually intended Jar Jar Binks to be a Sith Lord.
Yeah. All right. Okay, we're squashing that one.
We're squashing that one.
Done.
It's still a fun theory.
Yeah. So look, Jar Jar Binks, basically, good guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Good guy.
Good guy.
He's not trying to do anybody any harm. He's trying to help people. You know, sometimes he helps the wrong people, but that's all good.
Yeah.
Like, he's all right. And I think that's what Ahmed Best really loved about playing the character. He told Wired last year, there's a heart to Jar Jar that people don't really get. He's the most loyal character in Star Wars ever. As Qui-Gon and Jar Jar are walking through the forest, he says, I owe you a life debt. But that sincere moment is soon eclipsed. The jokes take over, and the slapstick takes over, and the physical comedy takes over. He was a little bit on the nose.
Yeah. So. You know, he admits it. I mean, the interesting thing there about, you know, where he's talking about Qui-Gon and Jar Jar walking through the forest, I mean, I don't think we've really talked this episode about that's one of the purposes, one of the roles Jar Jar plays in The Phantom Menace that I think maybe gets overlooked sometimes. Is like, yeah, he's embarrassing and he's a klutz and he's a fool and whatever. It's like, yeah, that's the point. The point is that he is all those things and Qui-Gon accepts him and Qui-Gon sees him as, you know, a worthwhile person, and he ends up playing this huge role in, you know, in the final conflict. I mean, the whole point of that is to show that Qui-Gon is a compassionate person, and that, you know, there's a,
even though he wasn't at the start.
The
ability to speak doesn't make you intelligent. But yeah, he comes around.
So it wouldn't say as much about Qui-Gon's character if Jar Jar was like this awesome dude they picked up that Qui-Gon then takes under his wing. You know, it's like, why wouldn't you? That guy's awesome. It says more about Qui-Gon that he took Jar Jar with him, even though he is an idiot.
He's basically carrying on almost exactly like Yoda is when we first meet Yoda.
Kind of, but he's not faking it.
Not faking it, though. Yeah. Or is he?
Hey.
So that lovely piece by Ed Cumming in The Guardian has this to say about Jar Jar. Jar Jar was hated because people thought he was out of place, but the opposite was true. The same people who went online to list ways to murder him are those who take the garbled mutterings of an antediluvian swamp frog, Yoda, as great wisdom. Jar Jar was the whole essence of Star Wars. He was awkward, but trying his best in a complex galaxy, pitted against the vast forces of evil. Unlike the po-faced Jedi, he didn't have magic on his side. He made mistakes, but he was capable of surprising feats under duress. He was funny and warm and slightly hapless. Misa Jar Jar. We also Jar Jar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that leads me to probably my biggest hot take of this entire podcast ever.
I'm ready for a scorching hot take.
All right, you ready for this?
All right.
So Jar Jar's an everyman hero. He's a galactic Forrest Gump, right? He's been at the inception of everything big that happened in the galaxy.
Yeah.
Is he the prequel stand-in character for George Lucas? Okay, so
this is a confusing take. Right. I don't know if it's...
Okay, so in the original trilogy, Luke was the stand-in character for George Lucas.
Yeah.
He's the guy in the dusty desert town who gets out. But it kind of stops there. I mean, Luke goes on to be successful. George goes on to be successful at great cost, both of them. And, you know, but, you know, I guess that George didn't ever have to murder his father. So, you know, it's all very vague from that point on.
True. But George was, you know, exiled by Disney.
That's true. But I'm thinking that Jar Jar's experience in these movies, in the prequels, kind of mirrors George Lucas's experience of making the original trilogy. We've talked on podcasts before about how George kind of has these wild ideas about, you know, and he says there were 9 films, there were 12 films, there were 6 films. And,
yeah,
you know, he basically surrounded himself with people like ILM who just got stuff done the way he wanted it done.
Yeah.
And sometimes he didn't even really know, like, where the story was going. You know, we talked about how the Vader father thing was clearly shoehorned in after Star Wars had come out.
Yeah. Very, very well done, but
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I'm just thinking, you know, Jar Jar basically being in the middle of everything and succeeding against the odds despite all the chaos happening around him. And, you know, George has spoken freely about, you know, how chaotic he felt his experience of making these films was and how he felt under pressure, overwhelmed. Maybe he's just a guy who was in the right place at the right time. Like when we meet Jar Jar, he's steamrolled by something huge. And he's swept up on this terrifying, thrilling, grand adventure. And he manages to succeed mostly by luck and moxie. I mean, that's George. He's been making his little independent films. And that's like analogous to Jar Jar grabbing frogs in the swamp for a snack. And then this Star Wars juggernaut comes along, smashes him flat. And he gets up and he's, you know, suddenly swept off on this grand adventure. And somehow he manages to be in the right place at the right time. And everything goes okay. That's my hot take. It's not little Anakin Skywalker that's the George Lucas stand-in character. It's Jar Jar Binks.
Interesting. I don't
come
know.
Come at me.
I don't think I agree with it, okay. But it's interesting.
Well, that smells stink-a-whiff.
I think I'd come up with that when I was drinking.
So now?
So no, yeah. Just now, yeah, just now, yeah. All right, that's fine. Most geniuses aren't appreciated within their own lifetimes. But look, one of the great things about this is that that tweet that Ahmed sent out was harrowing, for sure. There's no question. But it seems that, you know, the discourse around that has made him go to a better place now. So he tweeted a few days ago, thank you for all your love and kindness. It's been overwhelming. I'm going to start writing this show, by which he means the show.
The one-man show.
Where he's going to start talking about his experience. Going to need help, because I've never done this before. I'll be trying stuff out and posting it here. Let folks know. Thanks for all your support. It means so very much to me. Wow. I mean, like if he's taken something really positive away from this experience of sharing his pain... If he's going to write this one-man show, if he's going to talk about the experience of being torn down to nothing and building himself back up, like, single-handedly, basically, being abandoned by everyone who ever trusted, and, yeah, it's going to be a compelling piece of art.
Yeah.
And it's going to be very relevant to our times. It's going to be great. He says he doesn't know anything about how to do it. I reckon he's the man who's probably ideally placed to do it.
Well, no one else, you know, is placed to tell his story.
Except Kelly Marie Tran.
Yeah. unfortunately, no, true, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, I could easily see that show being a massive, you know, a huge, you know, attraction if he took it around America or even the world. I mean, this is a, you know, everybody knows about Jar Jar and everybody knows about the backlash against Jar Jar.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there'd be tons of people who'd be interested in actually hearing about it from the man himself. I mean, at the very least, it would kill it at Celebration.
Yes, that's it. Well, that's my first thought. It would kill it at Celebration. But seriously, if he does this the way I'm kind of thinking he will, it's a fringe festival show. It could go to any fringe festival in the world. It could tour constantly.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows Jar Jar. He's clearly funny. You know, he's clearly got a bit of a grounding in comedy. Whether, you know, it's probably more physical comedy, but I think he could ace the stand-up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he'd be brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Mark Hamill did a one-man show at, I think he's done it at a few Celebrations now. Yeah. And that got a huge response. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, Mark Hamill's show is really entertaining. But we know those stories. To hear Ahmed tell his stories, you know, I think that's kind of, it's sort of a great untapped resource. And, yeah. You know, we've heard obviously like Warwick Davis does shows at every Celebration and, you know, Ray Park's been coming back to do a few, but yeah, I mean, I think Ahmed Best, like it's one of the great, you know, he would have such a fascinating story to tell about his experiences on both, you know, on The Phantom Menace and on all the films since in a one man show kind of format.
That's right.
I would definitely go.
And I nearly cried reading his tweet.
Mm.
Like, you know, imagine what you could do putting that into an hour long show.
Yes.
Yeah.
It could be the Nanette of, yes, of Star right. Wars yeah. One man shows.
Could be. I guess what the whole thrust of this episode of the podcast has been about is that there are a lot of people out there, grown people, who say that the prequels ruined their childhoods, by which they mean the prequels tarnished three films they loved as kids. That's utter hogwash, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, first of all, the prequels don't need to and shouldn't change how you watch the original trilogy. You don't like them, don't watch them again. Ignore them, forget them, but most importantly, shut up about them. Second, if that's what allegedly retroactively ruined your childhood, a small boy yelling yippee and a computer-generated frog, then boy, did you have an awesome childhood. Seriously, saying that is an insult to anyone who's had or is having a genuinely bad childhood. There are kids in cages right now. There are kids growing up in poverty who've never even been to the movies. Only one childhood got ruined by The Phantom Menace, and that was Jake Lloyd's childhood. Like, I get it. Star Wars is a big deal to some of us. It's a big deal to us. It's a modern mythology. But at the end of the day, it's just a story told by someone else. If you don't like that story, you can totally walk away, move along. But not liking that story doesn't give you the right to ruin other people's enjoyment of it. And it certainly doesn't give you the right to ruin real people's lives. Real people who were caught in the crossfire. Professional people who were just hired to do a job to the best of their ability. Reminds me of a quote from the 29th President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. He was giving a famous speech at the Sorbonne in Paris in 1910, and he said, "It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is not effort without error and shortcomings, but who does actually strive to do the deed. Who knows the great enthusiasm, the great devotion, who spends himself in a worthy cause. Who at the best knows, in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat."
One of the great presidential speeches, and only slightly tarnished when he came out the next day and said what he meant to say was, "It is not the critic who counts."
Yes, that's right. No, I just feel that the people who jumped on Ahmed Best and drove him to think about jumping off the Brooklyn Bridge are cold and timid souls who will neither know victory nor defeat. Those classic kind of keyboard warrior types.
Yeah.
And I still feel shame that I had heaped scorn upon Jar Jar Binks all those years ago. I still feel bad about that it contributed to the pain of one man. And I feel very sorry about that, Ahmed Best. I apologize to you. And that tweet really made me think about all these things in the modern context too of what's happening with Last Jedi. And it's a very sobering thing to think about. We do love Star Wars so much that sometimes it blinds us to, you know, real world struggles. Everybody's fighting a battle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I mean, yeah, I mean, agreed. I mean, obviously, for anything that I've contributed towards, any anti-Jar Jar hate out there, that, you know, any of that negative energy that Ahmed was, you know, was picking up on that day on the bridge, you know, I apologize for that as well.
Now, this has turned into a Jar Jar Haters Anonymous.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I'm 15 days clean, Ahmed. I'm sticking the course. Yeah.
I'm probably going to fall off the wagon here and there. You know, I'm sure I'll utter some anti Jar Jar sentiments at some point or another. But, you know, hey, it's not. Certainly none of it is personal or directed at Ahmed.
It started with me uttering some anti-Jar Jar sentiments. Before I knew it, I was on eBay looking for a vintage collection Jar Jar and Carbonite figure.
Oh, here's one.
we've had a few laughs in this podcast. There's a serious side to it, though, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't sort of acknowledge that we talked about suicide at various points in this podcast and maybe throw out some numbers that if you need some help in counselling, you can call.
Yeah.
In Australia, Lifeline is on 13 11 14. If you're listening in the USA, the National Suicide Prevention Helpline is 1-800-273-8255. And in the UK, SANE is on 0300-304-7000. I know it's a bit more serious than you're used to from a Force Material podcast, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't say that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're going through anything, you know, anything comparable to what Ahmed was going through, I mean, definitely reach out and call one of those numbers, or just call, you know, call somebody who's close to you, because people do care.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's you're more loved than maybe you realize you are. And things are never as bad as you think they are.
And life is far too short to let a unit of entertainment, you know, be caught up in matters of life and death.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a re-examination of Jar Jar. Did we get it right? Do you think that, you know, he's not as bad in retrospect as he was 20 years ago?
And, you know, we're not saying you have to love Jar Jar now. You know, I don't love Jar Jar now. You know, we're just saying, hey, we're well past the time when people are sort of, you know, kicking Ahmed Best on a daily basis, probably. Yeah. But obviously you can see the parallels to the current films.
You can.
You know, and you can see that, you know, if this stuff affected Ahmed Best to that degree, who's to say it hasn't, you know, it doesn't also affect a Kelly Marie Tran to that degree.
And, you know, it's, as we said 20 years ago, it was MySpace messages. this is, you know, the internet has become so pervasive and social media has become so all-consuming that the first thing we do in the morning is roll over and check our phones.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be so much worse these days for anyone who's been hated onto that level.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm.
So we'd like to know your thoughts, I guess. We'd like to know what you think of Jar Jar 20 years on. I mean, it'll be 20 years next year, right? Anniversary of Phantom Menace.
Yeah, we're building up to the 20th anniversary of Phantom Menace, which should be exciting. We'll be definitely trying to sort of count down to that along with everybody else.
When I sat down to watch it 2 weeks ago, I was really entertained. And I actually found myself thinking, when my kid's kind of old enough to get this, he's probably going to really love Jar Jar.
Mm.
You know, and it made me think, well, you know, Jar Jar, yeah, he's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not cool.
He's for the kids.
He's for the kids. Hey.
Yeah, no, I mean, I put on Phantom Menace probably a month or two ago, just as like a sort of movie to have on in the background while I was doing stuff. And it's kind of just subtly worked its way into my... Mm. I'm just constantly putting it on in the background while I'm doing stuff now. I don't know, like maybe... I don't know if subliminally it has anything to do with the Ahmed Best stuff or just a general feeling that we've underappreciated this movie or what it is. But all right, well, send us an drop us a line at forcematerial@gmail.com to let us know where you're at with Jar Jar. If you've reevaluated Jar Jar over the years, or just you can get in touch with us.
Yeah. Or just in the light of Ahmed's tweet, you know, has that made you catch yourself on? Like it's made me.
Yeah, like have you sort of found yourself asking, you know, any questions about maybe how you've, you know, talked about Jar Jar over the years,
or indeed any character?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You can also get in touch with us at Force Material on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We're pretty easy to track down on all the various social media channels. Anytime you want to have a chat about anything Star Wars related, as we said at the top of the pod, we'll be back probably around the same time this hits your podcatcher of choice, with our a recap of SDCC, San Diego Comic Con, assuming that anything exciting happens at San Diego Comic Con, but it looks like it will.
There'll be nothing.
Hey, yeah.
Can't think of a single thing.
Can't think of a single thing. That keep an ear out for that one if you want to hear our thoughts on whatever, you know, publishing, TV, film, new sort of news comes out of that weekend. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
Music or Jar Jar Binks.
And you've just taken your first steps into a larger world.